There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. But how do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day, as contentious as they are, as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? People do not need just another piece of our mind. They don't need another opinion piece. What they need is the very peace of the mind of Christ. So how do we give that to them? That's the conversation we're seeking to provoke here on The Reconnect. You can connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, sign up for our email newsletter. We'll give you lots of information and commentary we don't have time to share here on the air. You could like The Reconnect on Facebook. You could always let me know what you're thinking about. I'm on Twitter, at Carmen LaBurge. Actually, on Twitter is where I engage most often with our next guest. His name is Eugene Scott. He's a reporter for CNN. He covers national and identity politics. He's a multiple award-winning journalist. His work has appeared in the USA Today, The Washington Post, Newsweek, NPR, and notably CNN. He reports regularly with Early Start, CNN Newsroom, The Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer, and Anderson Cooper 360, as well as CNN International. And again, he is on Twitter at Eugene_Scott. Eugene, welcome back to The Reconnect.
So good to be back. How are you?
Well, I am well. I am well. Now, one of the reasons we're talking to you today is because you are in D.C., and we would really like to know just sort of what it feels like in D.C. this week. You know, when the cover photograph in both The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times is a group of people huddled together in the middle of a baseball field praying, you know, something's a little different. So just give us a sense of what it feels like in D.C. this week.
Yeah, I mean, definitely has become the national conversation following a terrible shooting on Wednesday has just really caught the attention of both sides of the political aisle. And I think what just really surprised me most is how much the conversation spread beyond Capitol Hill. And so when I have been in restaurants this week or hanging out in neighborhoods that, you know, are relatively far from the White House or Capitol Hill, and seeing people still talking about what happened Wednesday and quite frankly, the Sessions hearing earlier this week, and still Comey's hearing the week before. That's a feeling that I just don't know to be the common feeling in D.C., this sense that it's interest in what's happening on the Hill is going beyond the Hill.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that for those of us who are, you know, obviously not inside the Beltway or even there in, you know, in the larger D.C., you know, region, when you start talking about, hey, Steve Scalise is a guy from Louisiana, and he's got a family that lives in Louisiana, and you know, and folks there are concerned about their congressman. And then you sort of add to that the baseball game, which everybody has a great affection for. I think that there are some layers to this particular story that that help make it feel local for everybody, and that this was a guy, you know, from Illinois. And you know, frankly, we all know people who've gotten to the place in their life where things are not great, and they're, as this guy was, living in his van for a while. I just think that there's so many layers to this particular story that people find a point of connectivity with. Now, I guess the point I hope they don't find connectivity with is I'm going to get so mad and I'm going to feel so out of control of the situation in the country and in my own life that I'm going to go and do something, you know, that frankly puts the lives of other people at risk. So let's move on from that, though, and let's talk about the Russia investigation. I mean, you allude to it a little bit when you talk about Comey's testimony, you talk about the Sessions testimony. I think that what we're hearing today is interesting to us. However, when, you know, we're just out here in flyover country, Tell us what you think it feels like in terms of the level of intensity, the Russia investigation. Does it feel like the special counsel investigation is now, peeling back lots of layers of the onion, even beyond the initial, maybe initially what we thought this was going to be about?
Yeah, I think things have heated up even today. I think quite a few people following the testimony of James Comey, the former FBI director, were under the impression that perhaps the investigation was not as serious as they thought before, because he said that the president did not ask him very specifically to end the investigation. And so I think last week closed with some people continuing to believe that things were overhyped. But just this morning, the president himself took to Twitter, which he frequently does, to somehow suggest that he actually is under investigation. And this is part of a story that the Washington Post broke last night about the special counsel, Robert Mueller, investigating the current president. And so, I mean, that is another level than what we were looking at before. There were quite a few different investigations into Russia's role in the 2016 election, but the president himself had never been specified as being a focus of an investigation. But this week that changed, along with looking into the role that Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, and one of his advisors may have played in all of this.
Yeah, it's certainly getting seemingly more complicated and more expansive than maybe some people initially thought. Certainly something that we'll all keep watching. Well, it's quite a drama. There's no question about that. So it occurs to me that the summer session of Congress is supposed to be, you know, this big push forward on major policy initiatives. So give us a little insight into, you know, what's happening. Is anything happening on healthcare reform, tax reform, the rest of the GOP agenda?
Yeah, well, the biggest thing that may have been happening this week in particular was today, the president announcing that he was going to roll back the advancements that President Barack Obama made related to Cuba and its relationship with the U.S. in terms of trade and travel and business. The president made it very clear that he wants Cuba to release many of its political prisoners and move forward in establishing a democracy before the U.S. government seriously considers lifting sanctions from trade and other business dealings with Cuba. And secondly, the president was in Wisconsin earlier this week announcing his desire to bring more jobs back to the community, which is something he campaigned heavily on. And that was a continuation of his announcement to launch an apprenticeship program to provide economic opportunities for people beyond those who go to a traditional four-year college, which quite frankly is most Americans over 25. And so there is some work being done. I don't think what the White House is doing the best job of is using social media to highlight that work and get that message to the people who are most concerned about that.
So I'm sure that that I won't be the first person to make some kind of joke over about the fact that President Trump is starting an apprenticeship program. But people used to really want to be his apprentice. So one of the things that I saw that, you know, I haven't seen heavily highlighted in the White House's social media, and I have a suspicion as to why, but my listeners might be interested to know that the Department of Homeland Security has announced on its website that the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which we recognize as DACA, is going to actually continue. They're going to continue to be eligible to renew every 2 years. That this is just a little brief quote, no work permits will be terminated prior to their current expiration dates. So there's like 800,000 Americans who that affects directly, and then obviously 800,000 families whom that affects indirectly. And I'm sure that I now have listeners who are saying I should have described that as 800,000 people in the United States, because these are folks who came to the United States as children, whose parents brought them here illegally. So this would be one of those things that you don't see the White House highlighting on social media, because the people who are paying attention to them on social media are going to recognize this is a reversal of what Donald Trump promised in his campaign.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is a policy that many people on the left support. And there was some thought that President Trump was campaigning on, quite frankly, being willing to send undocumented people back regardless of how they came here or their age. And that was a very controversial idea. But it definitely seems like something that people who have been critical of the president's immigration policy for being perhaps insensitive or too harsh would find favorable. And so it'll be interesting to see how this continues to move forward in the context of other larger conversations about immigration reform.
Hey, Eugene, thank you so much for joining us today on the Reconnect. We appreciate your work and we appreciate your sharing with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Hey, friends, that was Eugene Scott from CNN. You can follow him on Twitter at Eugene_Scott, and you can check him out all over the place on all of the CNN formats, as well as in places like the Washington Post and the USA Today. All right, Father's Day is coming up this Sunday. Before time gets away from us, I should say, hey, if you want to call in today and you want to give a shout out to your dad, or you want to give a shout out to the Father above, I'm open to that. So the number here is 877-655-6755. You can call or text me a tribute of thanks to your dad, or a tribute of thanks to our Father in Heaven, who has adopted us into his family as children who are born because of who Jesus Christ is and because we are adopted through him. So again, the number is 877-655-6755. If you want to give a Father's Day shout out or Father's Day tribute to your dad or to the Father above, I'd love to hear it. And again, that number works as both a phone number and a text line. And that's 877-655-6755. Friends, all next week, I'm going to be broadcasting live from Tampa, Florida. I'm thankful for the opportunity to fill in next week as a guest host on the Bill Bunkley Show. You'll be able to hear me on that program and on the Reconnect on letstalkfaith.com or listen locally in the Tampa Bay area on Faith Talk 570 WTBM AM 910 and FM 102.1. So one of the stories I'm definitely going to return to next week, but I didn't want to just skip over today, is this breaking news story that frankly is troubling on so many levels. Let me introduce it this way. Do you remember when you were a kid and somebody said, hey, you know, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me? Well, there's a teenager whose name is Michelle Carter, who texted thousands of, I'll just describe it as a barrage of text messages, and then ultimately had phone calls during this suicide experience of the person who I will describe as her ex-boyfriend. She encouraged him to kill himself over and over and over again. And even when during the process of taking his own life, he hesitated, she ordered him to proceed. So Michelle Carter has now been convicted of manslaughter in what is regarded as a texting suicide case in Taunton, Massachusetts. So I'll read the lead of this from Catherine Sheely and Jess Bidgood in the New York Times. And this is just news that popped today. A young woman who sent a barrage of text messages to another teenager urging him to kill himself was found guilty Friday of involuntary manslaughter in a case that many legal experts had expected to result in an acquittal. The verdict, handed down by a judge in a non-jury trial, and that's because it's in juvenile court, by the way, because she was 17 when this occurred, was a rare legal finding. Essentially, a person's words alone could directly cause someone else's suicide. So I want you to think about that for a moment. When we think about sticks and stones breaking our bones, but words never hurting us, is it possible for words delivered via social media and over the telephone to be so impactful that they would move a person to the point of taking their own life. So the judge, Lawrence Moniz of Bristol County Juvenile Court, said that the conduct of Michelle Carter toward Conrad Roy III was not only immoral, but was illegal. Ms. Carter now faces up to 20 years in prison and will be sentenced on August the 3rd. So here's basically what transpired. She wanted this group of popular girls to like her, and she thought that having them feel sorry for her because her boyfriend committed suicide would be a way of becoming more popular in this set of girls whom she apparently admired. And so she provoked this young man, who she knew was certainly having suicidal thoughts and had actually made one attempt on his life a year earlier. She knew that this was a fragile individual. And so, but you say to yourself, is suicide, however, not something that results from a person's free will? Is it not something that's limited to the individual? And here's basically what the judge says. Look, he breaks the chain of self-causation when he exits the vehicle, when he takes himself out of the toxic environment. And then she actually instructed him to get back in the truck, well knowing his fears and his concerns. And it was the ordering this young man to get back in the truck, where he would then die by carbon monoxide poisoning, that actually led the judge to convict her of manslaughter. So I raise this story up to you because it's tragic on so many levels. I'm going to bring you some additional thoughts on this next week. But if you're a parent of a teenager, I want you to be educating yourself about teen suicide, the popular Netflix series 13 Reasons Why. We have resources posted online at reconnectwithcarmen.com to equip you on this specific subject. Coming up in July, I'm going to be posting a special interview with the founder of the Hope Line. His name is Dawson McAllister. Dawson has actually been the person on the phone with thousands and thousands of teenagers over the years, and has been an agent of keeping just thousands of kids from taking their own lives. So I look forward to sharing that with you. Hey, we've got Marty on the line from Nashville with a Father's Day shout out. Marty, welcome to the Reconnect.
Hey, Carmen, how are you?
Well, I'm well. Thanks for calling. What would you like to say today?
I want to give a shout-out to my dad, Richard Duren, who is in Riverdale, Georgia. He's a Marine veteran. He's 82 years old. Became a believer about 17 years ago, I think, after many, many years in church. And the thing that my dad taught me more than anything else was a work ethic. He was a union guy, worked for Ford. If they went on strike, he didn't just sit back and do nothing. He went out and found extra work. When he was laid off for extended periods of time, he found extra work. When I went to college, he did janitorial work in the evening after he worked at Ford all day long. Never caught him lazing around or waiting for something to happen. He always got out and got after it. And so if I have a work ethic of any kind at all, it's greatly because my dad did, and I watched him for all those years. So I want to give a shout-out to Richard W. Duren, Jr. in Riverdale, Georgia.
Marty, thank you so much for that tribute to your dad, and happy Father's Day to your dad. Thanks for calling us.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Oh, friends, I love that. What is it that you that makes you who you are because of who your dad is, or because of who your dad was? So my dad died when I was just 15 years old. And so when we celebrate Father's Day, I'm privileged to celebrate that with my stepdad, Ron, who married my mom just a dozen years ago. But when I look back all those many years to knowing my dad, see, I only knew my dad when I was a child and when I was a teenager. I didn't have the privilege of knowing my dad as an adult. And so I love it. I love these kinds of testimonies from Marty. Thank you so much again for calling us here on the Reconnect and giving a shout out to your dad. And I so appreciate that kind of testimony. Like, right? Our dads teach us things even when we don't necessarily recognize at the time what they're doing. The sacrifices that that dads make for us, and the way that dads love us, sometimes goes beyond our ability as kids to really understand. Hey, that's one of the things that David Drucker says in his tribute to his dad. David Drucker is going to be with us here on the show next week. You'll recognize his name as as a writer for the Washington Examiner, and he's actually sitting in the chair for Hugh Hewitt during Hugh Hewitt's time off the air on vacation. But the CNN posted David Drucker's tribute to his dad, and it's entitled, "My Dad Didn't Step Out of a Sitcom." And I want to read the last line first. This is what Drucker says about his dad. He says, "My dad passed away in March of 2013 after a battle with Alzheimer's. This will be my fifth Father's Day as a dad and my fourth without mine. I love my father, and I'll miss him dearly as long as I live." David Drucker talks in this piece, and remember, this is a senior political correspondent for the Washington Examiner and a CNN political analyst, and he's talking in here about the affection of his dad. And he talks about his dad, growing up as the only child of a very poor, a very poor immigrant family. His dad is a first generation American born to Jewish parents who worked very hard, but didn't necessarily, according to David, heap verbal affection upon his dad when his dad was a child. And so he talks about the way his dad verbalized love, and the way his dad, amidst his successes, taught David how to persevere, and in difficult times, demonstrated what it looks like to maintain not only a vision but a commitment to living your dream and being who you believe you're called to be. So David says this about his dad: "I strive to emulate the essence of the man, a true American success story, who excelled in his chosen profession and raised a family with all the love one man could muster." And when you read this, when you read David Drucker's tribute to his dad at CNN, one of the things that you'll recognize is, you know, this is now a grown man who is a dad, who's looking back at the way that his dad fathered him and parented him. And he's acknowledging, look, it wasn't like Mr. Keaton stepping out of a sitcom. This was not idyllic by any stretch of the imagination. But he says, you know, my grandparents loved my father, but they loved him in a way that that wasn't necessarily verbal. And so he says, my dad told us that he loved us every single day, flooding us with the kind of attention that I suspect he wanted and didn't receive from his own parents. I want you to think about that for a moment as you think about Father's Day. What does it look like to heap the kind of affection on your dad that he wishes he had received as a child? Just think about that, particularly if your dad is older, particularly if your dad is maybe not going to be in this world that many more years, right? I mean, we can anticipate when folks are in the waning years of life. And we know by this stage of life what they didn't get when they were little kids. And if you don't know that, then that's a conversation you've got to have. But what would it look like for you to heap the kind of affection and love upon your father that he wishes he had received as a little child? It could be love that he never gave you in the way that you wanted it when you were a little kid. But you as a Christian have the capacity to give love in far different ways than you've ever received here on earth. Because you've received a grace, we have received a dispensation of grace that goes far beyond not only what we deserve, but what any other human being could ever give us. So we can lavish the love of the Father in heaven upon the fathers of this world, even if our earthly dads didn't give us when we were growing up all of the love and affection that maybe we think we needed. All right, your dad might not have stepped out of a sitcom. My dad didn't either. But I think that each and every one of us on this Father's Day can certainly give glory to our Father in heaven, acknowledge who he is, and lavish the love of the Father on others here in this world. Particularly, maybe I should remind you, those who are living without their dads in their homes. All right, friends, The Reconnect is a listener-supported ministry by people just like you. I would appreciate it if you took a minute and visited us at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're at the website, become a reconnector. Reconnectors are our ministry partners who support us prayerfully and financially to expand the reach of the ministry to more and more people. You can find out more information at reconnectwithcarmen.com. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect. Indeed, God is perfect in all of his ways. He is a good, good father. We are trying to put him in his place back where he belongs, right in the middle of every one of our conversations. So we're talking about what people are talking about, equipping you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. That means that this week, this weekend, we're talking about Father's Day. We're talking about dads. We're talking about the importance of dads. And we're talking about, you know, the reality that, you know, not all of our dads walked out of a sitcom. So we invite you to connect with us online. The website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. So joining us now is someone who has been gracious enough to join us before. Her name is Dr. Michelle Watson. She's the founder of the ABBA Project. It's a ministry formed to help dads connect with their daughters' hearts. And she's also the host of a radio program and a podcast in Portland called The Dad Whisperer. She has a degree in biblical education, a master's in counseling psychology, and a PhD in health psychology. She's got a full-time counseling practice, and she's the author of Dad, Here's What I Really Need From You, A Guide for Connecting with Your Daughter's Heart. You can find her at drmichellewatson.com. Michelle, welcome back to The Reconnect.
Thanks, Carmen. I'm so glad to be back.
So I wish we were sitting together on a couch having this conversation, as we have done before, but we are separated by many miles, thankful for technology, talking about Father's Day this Sunday. Tell us why fathers matter.
Well, in a nutshell, it's because God says they do. So God, as we know, puts so much value on a dad's role, so much so that in the last verse of the Old Testament, he said, if a father's heart doesn't turn to his children, that he'll come and strike the land with a curse. So clearly, fathers have a powerful role in helping turn the tide of our country for the better.
Absolutely. But let's talk about that. What is the current state of fatherhood in our country? Where do things stand?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think any of us have to look very far to see the impact of that curse, do we? You know, and so a lot of the research focuses on fatherlessness. And in fact, I've been a part of a project that just finished with a Liberty University doctoral student that studied the ABBA project to see what happens when dads do it right. But rather than focus on the negative, Carmen, how would you feel if I just gave a flip side of it to say, here's what happens positively when a dad engages based on the research? Does that sound good?
Let's do that. I love positive.
Yeah, let's go with positive slant. So children who feel connected, there's the key. Feel the connection to their fathers. I'll just list a few of the many impacts of that. Kids do better in school, experience greater self-esteem, less depression. Okay, dads are going to love this one. Kids delay having premarital sex. Okay. And decreases in teen pregnancy as a result. Lower rates of substance use and report significantly less suicide attempts. And that's just some of the list. So clearly, fathers matter.
Yeah. I think there's no question that those of us who, who had a dad who turned his heart toward us, and we know as girls what that meant to us as little children, what it means to us as grown women. I'm a person who, my dad died when I was 15, but I'm privileged to have a stepdad who, there's just no question that he loves me. I don't think he knows quite what to do with these adult female children that he now has, but we love him and he loves us, and there's no question about that. So let's talk specifically about this turning of the father's heart to the child. Let's talk about the heart of a child. Let's talk about what it means for a father to pursue their child's heart. What are you talking about?
Okay, so I find it so interesting that God commands a dad to turn his heart, because I don't think it's as intuitive for most men that I've walked alongside the last few years, where head turns or head engagement, if you will, making decisions, is easier for them. So a way that I define it, Carmen, is to say head interactions rest on the lines and heart interactions rest between the lines. So a little bit more specific. So a head interaction is predictable and factual and content-driven. You know, it's information. Whereas a heart interaction, if a dad is saying, what does that mean to pursue the heart of my child? It's more intuitive, emotional, sensitive, heartfelt. So the clearer a dad's positive messages are to his kids, the less reading between the lines they'll need to do.
All right. Now, so when you say reading between the lines, why don't you just tell us a story that gives us an example of what you're talking about? Because you actually sit. I mean, when you talk about the Apollos, the ABBA project.
Right.
What you're talking about there is actually sitting with guys in a group and working through all of this, which is fascinating to me. So you've learned some things in that context, and you have some stories to share. So when you talk about reading between the lines, can you give us a narrative example of what you're talking about?
Okay, great example. Let me tell you about Andy, firefighter, four sons, youngest is a daughter, Megan, 17 years old when she's 17 when he comes to the ABBA project. And he's the kind of guy, Carmen, that, like, his phone went off one of the days that we had our meeting, and we hear this, and one of the guys goes, is your ringtone an elk call? And he goes, yes. The guys wanted to get him a shirt that said terminally male. I mean, this guy literally, if there was a wrong way to do it, bless his heart, he would do it. So Andy says one day, my daughter skips school all the time. She's a senior in high school. And when I say, why didn't you go to school? See, a head question. He wants information. Why didn't you go to school? He says, either the pricklies would come out and she'd bite my head off, or the wall goes up and she won't talk to me. And I don't know what to do. I'm out of options. Everything I'm doing isn't working. So he says, what do you got for me, Doc? And I said, okay, you're going to love me because I'm going to give you a two-word way to fix this. Right? Wouldn't most men go, that works for me? Two words?
Mm-hmm.
I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
I said, put the words I'm wondering in front of the exact same question and report back next time. So he goes home and says, Megan, I'm wondering, why didn't you go to school today? Same question. And she goes, oh, well, today we had an early release. And he's like, what just happened here? I said, your tone had to have softened, that she heard that at a heart level, that between the lines it was softer, more sensitive, and she must have heard it as a legitimate question rather than an attack. And he's like, whoa, well, the change in their relationship. She ended up graduating high school, going into the Marine Corps, had Dad dress up in his firefighting regalia and hand her her diploma and her flag and all that stuff. He's walked her down the aisle and is now a grandpa, engaged grandpa to her two children. Literally, when Dad's engaged at a heart level, I say soften the tone and then soften it again, and you're going to see positive results with your kids.
Mm. Hey, friends, we're talking to Dr. Michelle Watson. You can find out what we're talking about at drmichellewatson.com. The book is Dad, Here's What I Really Need From You, A Guide for Connecting with Your Daughter's Heart. The project is the ABBA Project, and the podcast and the radio show in Portland is the Dad Whisperer. So, Michelle, I think that right now we're actually touching on the critical issue, and it's not that dads don't love their daughters. It's that they're not communicating that in a way that's getting to the heart level that their daughter is actually experiencing it. Because they're dealing at a head level for the most time because, you know, that's frankly how a lot of guys operate. So let's talk about the sort of the anger withdrawal cycle. Because if I'm asked a question that's at a head level and I become defensive, he becomes angry and I withdraw. So talk with people about sort of how and why that happens and how to break it.
Well, and even let's add one more dynamic to what you just said, Carmen, and it's that men then perceive that dynamic as disrespect. And something rises up in them of, I am going to clobber that disrespect with intensity, which bombs. I mean, I ask every dad, how's that working for you? And they're like, it's World War III in our house, over sometimes the silliest of things, what she's wearing, a tone of voice, not doing chores. So I think most men would say, I find men that I work with say, I don't know what's going wrong, but I don't know what to do. Tell me, help. And so I say that anger cycle, withdrawal cycle, is when a dad is heated, I say to dads, if you really want to break it, what I would encourage is that you take a timeout. You know how with kids we say you're 3 years old, you get a three-year-old, three-minute timeout? I say literally take as many minutes of a timeout as correspond to your age. If you're 45, take 45 minutes, walk around the block, get out of the room before responding, because what you're going to do is cool off the midbrain, emotional center, where you're reacting from, that floods the frontal lobe so you can't think real clear and you're going to say things you regret. So there's a practical way, Dad, if you really want to break the anger cycle. Dad's number two, remember that when you express disappointment to your children, you will actually get farther than your anger. Every kid I talk to says, I hate it when I know I've disappointed my dad. Another thing, if a dad says, I really want to break the cycle, is look in the eyes of your child. After you've delivered a message, look at their eyes, because you will see the impact of what you've said into their heart space by what their eyes say. And I think I'll just even give one more extra credit idea if a dad wants to break the anger withdrawal cycle, and is to really think back and connect with what it was like for you as a kid at the age of your children now, when your dad got angry with you. Because if you tap into that, I believe it will impact in a positive way the way you react to your kids now.
So I, as you say that, and I think about men in my life who are having a hard time in this area right now. If you go to that last one, mm-hmm. most of them are going to start crying because their relationship with their dad at the age that their kids now are is part of the reason why they don't know how to do it better or differently today. So can you talk about that? Can you talk about how we figure out how not to parent as we were parented?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think going to the place of the wound is the first step. Because I think a lot of times we think, and then we misquote scripture, forgetting what lies behind, right? Pressing forward to what lies ahead. I'm like, wait, look at that passage. Paul has just listed all the things he did in the past. He's not mm-hmm. saying they don't matter. He's saying they're not my identity, because my identity is in Christ. And I think a lot of dads were delivered a blow by their fathers that were negative, that they have now woven into their identity. And so now, without even knowing it, out of the wounded place, they're interacting with their kids. And so I say, dads, if you really want to go to the place of the injury, is go back to that story and ask yourself the question, where was Jesus? Ask Jesus that question, or God the Father, where were you in that room when my dad delivered the blow? And you will have him meet you in that place, I promise you. I think a lot of men go, I'm not good at that kind of stuff. I'm like, but God isn't gender specific, right? He doesn't say, I'm going to meet women in that way and leave men out. I even wrote my blog. I do a Dad Daughter Friday blog. And just today I wrote it to dads of daughters. And I talked about how just last weekend I had a dad talk to me who said, I'm a terrible father. I never should have been a father. And I just began weeping for his kids. But then I said, I'm weeping for you because mm-hmm. you're believing a lie that your story can't be rewritten. And I know a God that rewrites stories. I love Psalm 38:9 that says in the Message Bible, God rewrote the text of my life when I opened the book of my heart to his eyes. So God rewrites stories.
All right. I love that particular reference. All right, friends, you can go to drmichellewatson.com. You can check out the blog. The book is Dad, Here's What I Really Need From You, A Guide for Connecting with Your Daughter's Heart. The project is the ABBA Project, and you can check out what Michelle is talking about every day on the podcast.
And I'm starting a Virginia ABBA Project in the fall, so men on that side of the country can write me.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, I think that, I just talked to Nicole...
Johnson.
Yes, yesterday. So she gave me these three points that I clearly desperately needed. And first is you got to identify the crazy, and it might be you, which in my case it probably is. And then she said you got to go to your room. And so when you say, you got to give yourself a timeout, and it's got to be sort of like as long as so mine now is, it's 49 minutes. And so, but I love this. I love that the two of you are really echoing one another. She's really speaking to women. You're really speaking to men, but you're both talking to all of us. And you both land in the same place, which her line yesterday was, strike while the iron is cold.
Mm.
And again, that's that, you can't really have the kinds of conversations that any of us need to be having when your temper is so hot that you're totally irrational. And,
right.
And even if you were rational, that's not a heart language anyway. That's a head language. So I love that what I'm hearing from, what God's pouring into you and what God's pouring into Nicole and others, he really is working hard to get this message into our culture and into our families. So I want to thank you for the way you are doing that in the lives of dads and through the ABBA Project. We'll celebrate the launch of the Virginia ABBA Project when you get that going. And thanks so much for being with us again here on The Reconnect.
Oh, it's been my joy. Thanks, Carmen.
Thanks, Michelle. All right, friends, again, that's Dr. Michelle Watson. You can find her at drmichellewatson.com. And the book is Dad, Here's What I Really Need From You, A Guide for Connecting with Your Daughter's Heart. So a quick update for you on Steve Scalise. This is an unfolding story that we have been following since Wednesday morning when a gunman sought to terminate the Republican congressmen and their staffers who were participating in a baseball game practice, a practice for the congressional baseball game, which took place on Thursday night. And I want to just give you, because while we have been talking today, the doctors have reported out on Steve Scalise's condition. He's a congressman from Louisiana. He's a ranking member of the Republican Party, which is why he had a Capitol Police detail. And those are the people who intervened and kept this from being what some fear would have been, an utter massacre. All right, so Scalise's doctor said the risk of death is substantially lower than it was when he first came in. Well, we would certainly expect so. Went on to say we expect him to be able to walk and hopefully run. That sounds less positive. And then we have this. Scalise is still critical. We are encouraged by improvement to his condition over the last 36 hours. He has stabilized. We know from the way others are reporting out of that same press conference, the injuries that Steve Scalise endured are best described by doctors on military battlefields. Like, those are the guys who see this kind of stuff. Our ER docs, our trauma docs here in the United States working at hospitals don't necessarily see the kinds of injuries from gunshot wounds and then the related, all of the things that are related to that. So let's be lifting up Steve Scalise and his family in prayer. Let's be lifting up the others who were injured in that incident. Let's continue to celebrate the Capitol Police who did a valiant job in bringing that situation to an end. And I think, you know, only appropriate, we need to be praying for the family of Mr. Hodgkinson. So, you know, the person who did this is we, you know, as I think always happens, this is not just an unknown person. This is a person who tried to engage politically. This is a person who tried to have his concerns heard. He actually called or emailed on several occasions his senator, Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, to express his political views. He volunteered for Bernie Sanders' campaign. I'm not laying any kind of blame here. I'm just trying to describe the fact that this is a person who tried to engage in the political process in a way that he thought would bring resolution to his concerns. And then I guess when that didn't come about, he took matters into what he considered to be his own hands. So anybody that knew Mr. Hodgkinson and certainly his family are in need of our ardent prayers today and in an ongoing way. All right, friends, time to jump below the fold. This is the point in the show where we like to lift up stories and make connections designed to help you start or engage in conversations that don't initially appear to be about God, but where the introduction of eternal principles might change not only the course of a conversation, but the way another person thinks. And you and I both know if we can change the way, well, not we, but if God changes the way a person thinks about something, they're gonna live differently, right? So ready or not, here comes what I will describe as augmented reality. Artificial intelligence, the integration of technology with biology, through, drumroll, computer chip implantation. So, you know, you might think this is like sci-fi. You might think we're only doing this to make it possible for people who can't speak to be able to speak because there's a chip implanted that communicates with a computer and enables their voice to be heard. No, this goes far beyond that. This is a little bit of the future has arrived. Now, I got to ask you, have you done in your own life, in your own church, in your own conversations at your Bible study, have you done the hard ethical work necessary to respond faithfully to questions arising from biotechnology? Because biotechnology is moving forward in ways and at a pace that most of us have not thought enough about to say, now, wait just a second. Other than it just makes me feel a little weird that you're going to implant that chip, microchip in my hand so I don't have to pull my credit card out of my wallet to use my FastPass or my E-Pass or to get on the train or into the building. The convenience offered by having the chip implanted and uploaded periodically with information without any additional invasion into my person, you know, a lot of us would just say, you know what, that actually sounds pretty convenient. I'll go with that. Have you thought about that? Just because you can, should you? I mean, should we do everything that is available to us to be done? I mean, that is really the question before us. And you're saying to yourself, well, why are you acting as if this is here or this is happening? Well, here you go. This coming to us just a couple of days ago. Here's the headline. Would you get your travel card implanted into your hand? Swedish commuters raise concerns over security and privacy, but are using microchips to pay for their journeys. So a Swedish rail operator says that about 100 of its customers already use the service. The firm does not microchip people itself, but more than 20,000 people have been microchipped. That's pretty much what's going on here. 100 people are using this microchip implant in their hand to get on these railway Swedish railway cars. They're using the implant as their payment. So you just, instead of obviously having to stand in line and pull out a credit card or make a mobile payment, this is just activated by a reader, much like if you've been skiing lately, there's a chip in your tag and you just ski on through. That's just letting them know who's on the lift, and that if you don't come back down, where they need to be looking for you. This article says the microchip implants are actually not new. An estimated 20,000 people already have them, using devices to swipe in and out of offices, paying for food, and now paying for this railway service. So once you've got one of these chips implanted, it can apparently, you can have your whole, everything added to it. You would never have to carry a wallet again. You wouldn't have to carry a credit card. You wouldn't have to carry an ID. You wouldn't have to carry a bus pass. You wouldn't have to, here goes like on down the list. We are at the place where you can. The question is, should you? Now, when we introduce these conversations, we're talking about technology, and we're talking about the integration of technology with the human body. So we're talking about biotech. And you say to yourself, well, we already implant a whole lot of stuff into our bodies. That's already technology. And that's true. You and I probably each and every one know somebody who has a pacemaker. There's probably a lot of us who know people who have some kind of external or even internal implanted pump that supplies particular medications. This goes beyond that. And so we have to have the conversation that goes to the question of should. And I don't know that many of us in our churches are doing that kind of thinking and having those kinds of conversations. So there you go. That's something to ask your pastor on Sunday. Hey, I could get a chip implanted into my body. Should I? Hey, this is the Reconnect with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBurge. Connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the podcast, donate to the ministry, share today's show with someone new. Have a great weekend, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.